and the consultants at the Rockefeller University Hospital. He has held over the years a good number of academic appointments, commencing with service during the war. He was later on a professor and chairman of the Department of Pathology at New York University, Bellevue Medical Center, from 54 to 58. Professor and chairman of the Department of Medicine, New York University, Bellevue Medical Center, from 58 to 66. Dean of the New York University School of Medicine from 66 to 69. Professor and chairman of the Department of Pathology, Yale, New Haven Medical Center from 69 to 73. And Dean of Yale University School of Medicine from 1972 to 73. And President and Chief Executive Officer of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center from July 73 to July 1980. He has held a number of hospital appointments throughout the United States. He has as well participated in government activities. For example, he was consultant, the Committee on Research, the President's Committee on Heart Disease, a member of the President's Science Advisory Committee from 67 to 70, chairman of the Committee to Review National Cancer Plan, the National Academy of Sciences, a member of the Health Research Council of the City of New York, chairman of the Overview Cluster of the President's Biomedical Research Panel, and a member of the Committee on Planetary Biology and Chemical Evolution, the Space Science Board. He is serving on a number of editorial boards and is a member of a large variety of scientific and professional societies. There's a long list of miscellaneous activities. I wonder how he finds the time to do these things. He's chairman of the board, the Scientists Institute for Public Information, member of the Advisory Council, the Program in History of Science, Princeton University. He has received a number of special awards. Dr. Thomas is the author of a book, The Lives of a Cell, for which he received the National Book Award in Arts and Letters. He received Modern Medicine's 1975 Award for Distinguished Achievement, Distinguished Service in Medical Journalism. He has been recognized by an award in literature, the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters, 1980, the Christopher Award for his work, The Medusa and the Snail, the American Book Award in Science for that same work, The Medusa and the Snail. He has been a visiting fellow, Clare Hall, the University of Cambridge, in 1981, and received an award for excellence in science communication, Scientists Institute for Public Information. We are indeed privileged this evening to hear from a man who has distinguished himself as a medical doctor, a teacher, a scholar in the government service, as a scientist, and as an author. He's well qualified to let us know something about those matters unsettled by science. Dr. Thomas.
Now that the 20th century is finally nearing its end, with less than 20% of its time still to go, a handful of years already slipping through our fingers, it is not too soon for us to begin glancing over our shoulders at it to see if it can be made to make any sense at all. Did anything good, really good, happen in this century, or was it all, as it sometimes seems, unrelievedly appalling, one bad thing after another? Was there a good side after all? Well, one thing at least. Here it is, 1982 going on 1983, and we haven't blown up the planet yet. We could have, but we didn't. We could do it tomorrow, any day, but maybe we won't. That word maybe is about the best I can do in the way of optimism. Get us out of this benighted century, I sometimes think to myself. Just get us out and into the next, and maybe then, maybe we can begin to look ahead. It has been the most scientific of all centuries, and there is something good to be said for that. What then? My answer will, of course, sound like the answer to be expected from a professional scientist, but I have a twist for it. I say that the science of the 20th century has made a more significant and more valuable contribution to human thought than all the centuries that went before, but I will then say that this contribution was the discovery of the profundity of human ignorance. I believe that what we have begun to learn, like it or not, is that we do not really understand this place. And this is a new event for human society. In our earlier periods, we have had neat, orderly explanations for everything about everything. And we have had explainers who doubled in brass as absolute rulers and sun kings and understood the whole world. To be sure, there were always puzzles for the philosophers, but there was also always a generally shared conviction that if we just thought hard enough and long enough, we could think our way through to any explanation we desired. We could make up any story we felt like to account for our existence and turn the story into dogma overnight. And now, thanks to science, we know that this is not possible. We can never reach an understanding of nature, much less of ourselves, by thought and thought alone. We need science, and we need the scientific method. This is what any working scientist would say, of course, out of self-interest as well as conviction, but what is not said plainly or often enough is that science is only now at its beginning and has centuries, millennia ahead. There are some scientists who would disagree with what I have just asserted. They would claim that we've done far better than I claim, that we have perhaps come our full distance, that we already know essentially everything of importance that is knowable, and that the upshot is that the world is absurd, making no sense, no sense at all. There is no such thing as meaning or purpose or progress or mystery, and there are no causes. The universe began with a big bang, a strange accident of some sort, and will end strangely by collapsing in upon itself. The everyday use of that banal, dismissive term, Big Bang, for that first great light is symptomatic. Do not use language for science that implies anything beneath the surface or beyond the grasp of the human intellect. Above all, do not look for meaning. Randomness rules the universe. Keep your head down. In one of her splendid Norton lectures at Harvard 2 years ago, Dame Helen Gardner had some sharply critical things to say about the influence of modern science on criticism, and particularly about the reductionist tendencies of contemporary literary criticism, and especially about the new criticism out of France known as deconstructionism, the reductionist fission of poetry, not line by line, but word by word and particle by particle. She was worried about the new dogma that a poem itself cannot possess any meaning whatever beyond the random insights brought to the words by the reader, the observer. The only reality to be perceived in a line of verse is a stochastic reality arranged by the observer, but not by the creator of the line. Dame Helen is dismayed by this affront to literature. She writes, "It marks a real loss of belief in the value of literature and literary study, dignified and partly justified by being linked with the universal skepticism about the possibility of any real knowledge of the universe we live in or any true understanding of the world of our daily experience. The indeterminacy," she goes on to say, "of literary texts is part of the indeterminacy of the world." And Joan Pizer, in an introduction to the new edition of her 10-year-old book on modern music, expresses a similar level of dismay at what science may be doing to music. She writes, "The lessening of greatness in the music of modern times can be traced to Darwin, Marx, Einstein, and Freud." And she adds, "The dissemination of their theories has propelled everything hidden into the light, and analysis annihilates mystery." The geneticist C.H. Waddington asserted in his book on modern art that some of the earliest manifestations of abstract expressionism in modern painting, notably the work of Kandinsky and his followers, came from a feeling of hostility toward early 20th century physics. Kandinsky said that scientists were only capable of recognizing those things that can be weighed and measured. Annie Dillard, in a perfectly wonderful new book of criticism called Living by Fiction, writing about the impact of modern physics on modern fiction, says, "Nothing is more typical of modern fiction than its shattering of narrative line. It is a flattened landscape. Events do not trigger other events at all. Indeed, any event is possible. The world is an undirected energy, an infinite series of random possibilities." And this, writes Annie Dillard, is the fiction of quantum mechanics. And she doesn't care for it. She believes there is meaning in the world and concludes that the lyric poets are the best equipped of all of us to find it. Well, I wish the humanists, wherever they are, the artists and writers and poets and critics and musicians, most of all the musicians, would leave physics alone for a while and begin paying attention to biology. Personally, having read my way through a long shelf of books written by physicists for non-mathematicians like me, I have given up looking for the meaning, any meaning at all, in the worlds of very small or very large events. I've become convinced that any effort to insert mysticism into quantum mechanics, or to get mysticism out of it, or indeed to try to force new meanings into the affairs of the everyday middle-sized world, is not for me. There are some things about which it is not true to say that every man has a right to his own opinion. I do not have the right to an opinion about a causality in the small world, nor about black holes or other universes beyond black holes in the large world, for I cannot do the mathematics. Physics, deep and beautiful physics, can only be spoken in pure, unaccented mathematics, and no other language exists for expressing its meaning, not yet anyway. And lacking the language, I concede that it is none of my business, and I'm giving up on it. Biology is something else again, another matter, quite another matter indeed. In fact, very possibly another form, or at least another aspect of matter, probably not glimpsed, or anyway not yet glimpsable by the mathematics of quantum physics. One big difference is that biology, being a more difficult science, has lagged behind, so far behind that we have not yet reached the stage of genuine theory in the predictive sense in which theoretical physics drives that field along. Biologists are still principally engaged in making observations and collecting facts, trying wherever possible to relate one set of facts to another, but still lacking much of a basis for grand unifying theories. Evolution is about as close as we have come, and it is certainly a grand and sweeping concept, but more like a wonderful puzzle filled with bits of information waiting for more bits before the whole matter can be fitted together. It remains necessarily an intensely reductionist field in science, requiring the scrutiny of endless details and then the details of the details before it will be possible to see a large, clear picture of the whole orderly process. And it will need decades of work, perhaps centuries, before we can stand back for a long look. It may even be that some of the information will lie forever beyond our grasp because of the sheer age and volume of planetary life and the disappearance from the record of so many crucial forms, crucial for comprehending the course of events. In fact, we can look back only a relatively short distance. Up until the 1950s, the fossil record on which the most solid parts of the structure of evolutionary theory were based provided a fairly close look at only the last 500 million years or so. We now know that there is a period of at least 3 billion years of life about which we know very little. And for most of that time, the sole occupants of the Earth were the prokaryotes, the bacteria, and I have no doubt their resident viruses. We tend to use words like early and primitive for such creatures, as though we members of the eukaryote world, possessing nucleated cells and on our way to making brains for ourselves, comprise a qualitatively different and vastly superior form of life. We tend sometimes even to dismiss 4/5 of the Earth's lifespan as a long, dull prologue to the real events in evolution, nothing but featureless, aimless bacteria around waiting for the real show to begin. It was probably not like that at all. Leave aside the excitement when the very first successful cell appeared, membranes, nucleic acid, ribosomes, proteins, and all, maybe somewhere in a quiet pool, maybe in the aftermath of a lightning storm, and maybe from a combination of energy sources, the sun, ionizing radiation, and volcanic heat. It can be told as a plausible story, easy to imagine, for all the necessary chemical building blocks were at hand or came to hand during the first billion years. And it should no longer come as a surprise that beautifully formed bacterial fossils exist in rocks 3.5 billion or more years old. I wish, by the way, that we had set up a better term, a nicer term, than primordial soup for the nutrients and clay surfaces in those early waters of the Earth. Soup is somehow too dismissive a word for a state of affairs as immensely important, more like the role of yolk in a fertilized egg, although that doesn't sound much better. Maybe it is an unexplored tradition in the language of science to to flatten out the prose for really huge events, like the term Big Bang. And what may be turning out these days to be the most profound and subtle of all mechanisms in evolutionary genetics is now known flatly and familiarly as jumping genes. The emergence of scientific slang might make a PhD thesis someday, starting with the physicists and their particles. Anyway, the first cell to appear on the planet was in all probability just that, a single first cell capable of replicating itself and a creature of great theoretical interest. But the events that followed over the next 2.5 billion or so years seem to me even more fascinating. It is entirely possible that that stretch of time was needed for the progeny of the first cell to learn virtually everything essential for getting on in a closed ecosystem. Long before the first great jump could be taken, the transformation of prokaryotes to eukaryotes around 1 billion years ago, a great many skills had to be acquired and mastered. During those years, the life of the Earth was, of course, made up of vast numbers of individual cells, each one replicating on its own, but it would have seemed to an outside observer more like a tissue, the differentiated parts of a huge organism than a set of discrete beings. And a rapidly developing organism at that, comparable, if you stretch the analogy a bit, to a gigantic embryo. In most places, and in the algal mats that covered much of the Earth's surface for a very long time, the microorganisms arranged themselves in neatly aligned layers, feeding each other in highly specialized ways and developing the mechanisms for cooperation and coordination, which I believe have characterized the biosphere ever since. The life of the planet began the long, slow process of modulating and regulating the physical conditions of the planet itself. The oxygen in today's atmosphere is almost entirely the result of photosynthetic living, which had its start with the appearance of blue-green algae among the microorganisms. It was very likely that first step, or that evolutionary jump, that led to the subsequent differentiation into nucleated cells, and there is almost no doubt that these new cells were pieced together by the symbiotic joining up of non-nucleated cells. The chloroplasts in today's green plants, which capitalize on the sun's energy to produce the oxygen in our atmosphere, are the lineal descendants of blue-green algae. And the mitochondria in all our cells, which utilize the oxygen for securing energy from plant food, are the progeny of ancient oxidative bacteria. Collectively, we are still, in a fundamental sense, a tissue of microbial organisms living off the sun, decorated and ornamented these days by the elaborate architectural structures which those microbes constructed for their living quarters, including seagrass and whales, and of course ourselves. We can imagine three worlds of biology corresponding roughly to the three worlds of physics. The very small world now being explored by the molecular geneticists and the virologists, not yet as strange a place as quantum mechanics, but well on its way to strangeness. And an everyday middle-sized world where things are as they are, and a world of the very large, which is the whole affair, the lovely conjoined biosphere, that vast embryo, the closed ecosystem in which we live as working parts, the place for which Lovelock and Margulis invented the term Gaia after the Earth goddess because of its extraordinary capacity to regulate itself, keeping the constituents of its atmosphere in a precise, optimal, and altogether improbable balance, maintaining the salinity and pH of its waters against all the odds of probability, and holding its temperature at a remarkably steady average over billions of years, despite what has probably been a cumulative 25% increase in the heat coming from the sun. This world seems to me an even stranger one than the world of very small things in biology. It looks to me like the biggest organism I ever heard of, and at the same time, the most delicate and fragile. Exactly the delicate and fragile creature it appeared to be in those first photographs catching the breath taken from the surface of the moon. It is at this level of things that I can find meaning in Wallace Stevens, although I haven't any idea that Stevens intended this in his Man with the Blue Guitar. They said, "You have a blue guitar, you do not play things as they are." The man replied, "Things as they are changed upon the blue guitar." It is a long poem filled with ambiguities, but it can be read, I think, as a tale of the earth itself. Some biologists dislike the Lovelock-Margulis view of things, although they agree that the regulatory homeostasis of the earth's life does exist as a real and puzzling phenomenon. They dislike that term Gaia, for one thing, because of its possible religious undertones, and they dislike the notion of design that seems implicit. How can the planet's life be that of a single organism and have evolved by natural selection when there was nothing to select against? One way out of that dilemma is to call the arrangement a system, and then assert, as I would, that this is the only way that complex systems can evolve and survive, by endless chains of regulatory messages and intricate feedback loops. It is not necessary, I think, in accounting for the evolution and now the stability of the Earth's atmosphere, to suggest that evolution itself can plan ahead. All you need assume is the existence of close linkages of interdependency involving all existing forms of life after the fashion of an organism. Finally, it is not a view of things, as some have claimed, that is likely to relieve human beings of any feeling of responsibility for the environment, backing them off from any concern for the whole place on grounds that look, it runs itself and has done so implacably since long before we arrived on the scene. On the contrary, I should think it would have just the opposite effect, imposing a new feeling of anxiety for the environment everywhere. If you become convinced that you exist as a part of something that is itself alive, you are more likely to take pains not to do damage to the other vital parts around you. Anyway, it seems to me a notion in biology not to be dismissed lightly and requiring a lot more thought and a lot more good science. Part of that science, by the way, can be done best by the technologies developed for space exploration. One thing discovered since NASA began its work, upon which I should think almost everyone would now agree, is that by far the most interesting, engrossing, and puzzling object in the solar system, and maybe in the whole galaxy, is our own planet. It needs more research, huge scale, and at the same time delicate, highly reductionist work, but in the meantime it is there for the humanists to think about, something new and amiable, a free gift from science and high technology, a nice piece of bewilderment for the poets, and an instruction in humility for all the rest of us. In the everyday, middle-sized world where I live, biology has only begun to work. Medicine, the newest and youngest of all the sciences, bobs along in the wake of biology, not yet sure indeed that it is all that much a science, but certain that if there is to be a scientific future for medicine, it can only come from basic biomedical research. I'm not sure who invented that convenient hybrid term biomedical. I think it was somebody from my professional side wanting to lay claims on respectable science by the prefix bio, but it could as well have been a pure biologist wanting to suffix medical as a way to lay hands on NIH grants. Whichever, it is a nice word and it contains some truth. Medicine is a branch of biological science for the long-term future. This means that I am entitled as a physician to ask my biologist friends to answer a range of questions that are not yet perceived as an immediate part of my own bailiwick, just as they can expect me and my colleagues to turn up some quick answers to problems like cancer and coronary disease and schizophrenia and heartburn, whatever. Indeed, the only question I am inclined to turn aside as being impossible to respond to happens to be one most often raised these days, not just by my biologist friends, but by everyone. The question about stress, how to avoid stress, how to prevent stress, allay stress. And I refuse to have anything to do with this matter, having made up my mind from everything I have read or heard about it in recent years that what people mean by stress is the condition of being human. And I will not recommend any meddling with that by medicine or any other profession. But I digress. What I want to get at is an imaginary situation in which I am allowed 3 or 4 questions to ask the world of biomedical science to settle for me by research and as soon as possible. Can I make a short list of top priority puzzles, things I am more puzzled by than anything else? Well, I can. First of all, I want a satisfactory explanation of human language. One nice thing that has just happened in linguistics, which looks to me like turning it into a genuine biomedical science discipline, is the discovery by Professor Derek Bickerton at the University of Hawaii, described in his new book, Roots of Language, that language is really made and then changed from generation to generation by children. Language is not built or controlled by academies or universities or governments or committees, nor by wise old men in coffee houses. Bickerton traced the origins of Hawaiian Creole, a perfectly organized, grammatical, flexible language which emerged explosively in Hawaii soon after 1880, when the islands were suddenly populated by sugarcane workers from Japan and China and Korea and the Philippines and Puerto Rico, all dominated by English-speaking people. Pidgin English appeared first, pidgin being the accepted mispronunciation of business, as in business English. And then within a single generation, borrowing words from all the other languages, Hawaiian Creole developed. The older generation of settlers could neither understand it nor speak it, nor could the English-speaking owners. It had to be the creation of the children, jabbering away at each other. The remarkable thing was that it had adhered from the outset to very tight syntactical rules with a complicated grammar which resembles the grammar observed in other Creole tongues, including the French Creole spoken in the Seychelles. And Professor Bickerton asserts that this is proof beyond Chomsky that our brains do contain a genetically set biological program for making grammar, that we are coded for speech. I'd like to agree with Bickerton if I knew more, and I would carry the notion one step further. Maybe it is for this reason that human beings go through such a long and vulnerable period of childhood. Our youngest people not only build the language, they change it one generation after another, always in accordance with fixed rules. If it were not for the children, we might still be speaking Chaucerian English, or maybe Hittite, or maybe old Indo-European. And second, I want to know what goes on in the mind of a honeybee. Is it true, as is often asserted, that a honeybee is simply a small, neatly assembled robot, an automaton, capable only of behaving in ways for which the bee is programmed by instructions in bee DNA, or is something else going on? In short, does a bee know what is going on in its mind when it navigates its way to distant food sources and back to the hive using polarized sunlight and the tiny magnet it carries as a navigational aid? Or is the bee just a machine, unable to do its mathematics and dance its language in any other way? To use Donald Griffin's term, does a bee have awareness? Or to use another term I like better, can a bee think and imagine? Well, there's an experiment for this, or at least an observation made long ago by von Frisch and more recently confirmed by James Gould at Princeton. Biologists who want to study such things as bee navigation and language and behavior in general have to train their bees to fly from the hive to one or another special place. To do this, they begin by placing a source of sugar very close to the hive, so that the bees, which are considered by their trainers to be very dumb beasts, can learn easily what the game is about. And then at regular intervals, the dish, or whatever, is moved progressively further and further from the hive in increments of about 25% at each move. Eventually, the target is being moved 100 feet or more at a jump, kilometers away from the hive. Sooner or later, while this process is going on, the biologist shifting the dish of sugar will find that his bees are out there waiting for him. And waiting precisely where the next position had been planned. This is an embarrassing observation to make. And harder still to explain in conventional terms. Why would bees be genetically programmed for this kind of behavior in their evolution? Flowers do not walk away in regular, predictable leaps. Well, one possible explanation put forward by Jim Gould, but with deep reservations and some doubt, is that bees are really very smart animals who know what the biologist is up to and can imagine where he will turn up with his sugar. Another possibility favored by Gould is that we simply do not understand this matter. And we need to learn a lot more about bees. I like that answer, and it's my reason for putting the bee question near the top of my list. My next question, addressed at large to the world of biology, concerns music. Surely music, along with ordinary language, is as profound a problem for human biology as can be thought of, and I would like to see something done about it. A few years ago, the German government set a large advisory committee to work on the question of what the next Max Planck Institute should be taking on as its scientific mission. The committee worked for a very long time and emerged with the recommendation that the new Max Planck Institute should be dedicated to the problem of music. What music is, why it is indispensable for human existence, what it really means, hard questions like that. The government, in its wisdom, turned down the idea, muttering something in administrative language about relevance, and there the matter rests. I shall take it as a sign of growing up in my country when we can assemble a similar committee for the same purpose and have the idea of a National Institute of Music approved and funded. I'm not going to wait up for this to happen. But I can imagine it starting on a very small scale and with a very limited mission and a very modest budget. A narrow question at the outset, like, why is the art of fugue so important? And what does this single piece of music do to the human mind? Does it, in fact, reproduce the sound of the human mind, thinking? Later on, there will be other questions harder to deal with. And while you're on your feet, science, I have one more question, this time one closer to medicine. Some years ago, Dr. Harold Wolff, professor of neurology at Cornell, conducted the following experiment. He hypnotized some healthy volunteer subjects, and while they were under deep hypnosis, he touched their forearms with an ordinary pencil, which he told them was an extremely hot object, and then he brought them out of the hypnotic state. In most cases, what happened was the prompt development of an area of redness and swelling at the skin site touched by the pencil, and in some subjects, this went on to form a typical blister. I want to know all about that phenomenon. I also want to know how it happens that patients with intractable warts of long standing can have their warts instructed to drop off while under hypnosis. Come to think of it, I'd rather have a clear understanding of this phenomenon than anything else I can think of at the moment. The bees and the music can wait. If it is true, as it seems to be, that the human central nervous system can figure out how to go about creating a blister at a particular skin site all on its own, or how to instruct its blood vessels and lymphocytes and heaven knows what other participants in the tissues to eliminate a wart, then it is clear that the human nervous system has already evolved a great distance beyond biomedical science. If I had a good wart, I'd be happy to be a participant in this experiment, and I will be glad any day to try my brain on a blister, but my motive for doing so would be less than worthy. If it worked, I would feel gratified by the skill, and I would be excessively vain and ready to dine out forever on the news that my own mind is so far outclassed by another part of my brain. I don't know why it strikes me as so overwhelmingly important that there might be inside my ordinary brain a thinking mechanism so vastly superior to what I recognize as my own mind. Like everyone else, I was brought up to accept, with as good grace as I could summon, the existence of an unconscious. But I've always regarded this as an error-prone, dreamy, dreary, slipshod sort of apparatus, always getting things wrong, turning things around so that things are never as they are, and arguing within itself after the fashion of an academic committee. It does surprise me then, and it delights me as well to think that there may be in there another mind much better than mine, capable of master class surgery, regulating me with exquisite precision without my having to lift a finger, more aware of me than I am, in short, a mind much smarter than the one I use in the everyday world, as smart maybe as a beehive, a flawless supermind. It takes only a short leap from here to imagine that some of us have better, stronger, more agile, more imaginative superminds than the rest. But what is an apparatus of this kind really designed to do? What is it for? How does it spend its time inside our heads, filled as it must be with its own awareness of the world? Well, I propose that this other mind, beyond our reach, beyond our governance, makes music and listens to music and thinks music. I don't much like the notion that music is the property of only half our brains and the fuzzier half at that. I like much more the idea that music involves the working of an entire brain plus the awareness of an entire body plus a feel for the universe. If I were a scientist just starting out looking for an explanation of the importance of music, I would not spend my time scrutinizing that everyday, workaday human mind. I would go looking for another level of consciousness, a separate apparatus, an awareness of which we are still unaware, a mind that is still way over our heads. Thank you.
As I said earlier, Dr. Thomas has agreed to answer questions.
Would you state the questions first?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Do you think a tone dead person could form a
wisdom? Nice. Do I think a tone deaf person could form a blister? That should be one of the first experiments. Sir.
A good many people, including myself, have this occasionally because of some particular attractive chord of music, a surge of feeling in yourself, and it brings tears in your eyes and so on. How do you explain a thing?
That's the kind of question I want the Institute to study. Yeah. It's a puzzle, isn't it?
What questions are there?
I'm thinking.
Could you repeat the question?
What questions, what matters are settled by science? And I guess I'd lay out a range in my own field of infectious diseases of the magnitude of tuberculosis, tertiary syphilis, lobar pneumonia, subacute bacteria, easy things now to handle that used to be 100% fatal. Indeed, they were 100% fatal when I was an intern.
Would you call that settled?
I'd call that settled with the reservation that even though I know how to get rid of those diseases and to prevent them and to kill off the organisms, I really don't have a very... The question was, after I launched into my litany of how good medicine is and how we can handle all kinds of infectious diseases, the question was, is that really a settled matter? And my answer, waffling, is that it really isn't. that although we can do nice technological things to control a broad range of infectious diseases, among which I'd say the most important and the major change that medicine has produced in my lifetime was to get rid of tertiary syphilis and to get rid of tuberculosis pretty much once and for all. Even so, I would concede that I do not understand how either of the organisms involved in those two extraordinary diseases accomplishes what it does accomplish once lodged in the tissues.
From the primitive existence, do you have any idea on what does it depend, what factors, what processes are going in our mind?
The question deals with inventiveness and what is it that goes on in our minds and has been going on for the last several centuries, I'd say, piling information upon information, getting us into this sort of century's stage in science and technology. I don't think anybody really understands this, at least I do not. There is a field called the philosophy of science, and there are a good many people who write about that topic, including the question of creativeness and the role of a hunch and the role of sudden transformations in the imagination.
But I do not understand it. All that I am sure of is that science advances not by adding new information to old information, but by replacing old information. Certainly in my own field, most of the information that has accumulated in the last 6 or 7 decades has turned out to be biodegradable and has soon been... We've most of the time discovered that we were wrong before, but now, of course, we are right. The question was, what did I mean by the art of fugue? And what I meant was a perfectly marvelous piece of music by Johann Sebastian Bach that was written in his last years and finished off just before he died. And it's an exploration of what can be done in fugue. And it may have had the final effect of ending the period of that kind of music, because nobody could dream of doing it better. But it's the kind of music that does sound to my ear like an announcement of something that I better learn about as quick as I can, and I never have. Genetics. What do I think is the most important factor in prolonging life? Well, the first answer is a trivial one. Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great American Boston doctor, once said that the key to longevity is to get a chronic incurable disease and then take good care of it. But I suspect that longevity is really determined by one's genes. There are families where people live a long time, and there are families where people live a short life. And I wouldn't think it was an urgent matter to change any of that.
Do you think, for practical purposes, the principle of natural selection is the mechanism of evolution, or is it just a mechanism, one of many? And if the latter, do you think possibly determination of the mechanism of evolution could possibly be added to your list?
No, I'm a true believer. The question was, do I think natural selection is the underlying mechanism in evolution, or is it a mechanism? And my answer is that I'm a true believer, and I think natural selection is the mechanism of evolution. But I get myself into a tangle with the other notion of Lovelock and Margulis, because as I said, it's hard to know what the planet was selecting against. So it is a puzzle.
Gave credence to the concept of mind being able to form blisters. Many scientists, when they hear of such stories, will treat them with what I would call a healthy degree of skepticism. Why, in this particular case, was the natural inclination of scientists to treat such a story with skepticism, which in many cases has been justified, as in cases like Uri Geller's performances, that suppose the scientist looks at these matters from more ephemeral they seem to be, why do you suspend your skepticism in this particular case?
The question is, why am I not more skeptical than I ought to be as a working scientist about Harold Wolff's experiments? And I guess my answer is that I knew Harold Wolff quite well. And that's really not a very good answer. To be perfectly candid about it, I wish that experiment were done over and over again by other groups, and it's been neglected. It's sitting in the literature, and very little has been done on it since then. There's another set of experiments on warts that induces the same puzzlement. A group at the Massachusetts General Hospital, not very many years ago, set up an experiment on the effects of suggestion under deep hypnosis. And they had, it was a nice experiment with good controls,
most of the subjects had intractable warts covering large areas of the body for at least a year prior to the experiment. And it was suggested to them that the warts on one side of the body would disappear, which they did in over a period of a couple of weeks, while the controls continued to have their warts. Trouble was that in a couple of patients, the warts disappeared on the wrong side of the body. Might have been, yeah.
What is your view on directed research, wars against cancer,
etc.? I have to go. What is my view on directed and targeted research, such as the war against cancer? I have to go carefully here because of my institutional affiliation. I am opposed to targeted, directed research aimed at specific disease problems. I don't think that we are likely to get on with the answers that we really need unless we have a great deal more of what Jim Shannon at the NIH used to call undifferentiated research. We have gone a long distance in the last few years on the cancer problem, but we've done so because of genuine basic research, mostly in the field of molecular genetics and mostly involving the recombinant DNA technique, but not much of it done under the direct influence of an obsession with cancer itself. And I rather suspect that when the answers, the really important and final answers, come rolling in, which I think they will within the next 10 years or so, they're going to roll in from fields like this one, especially cell biology, the matter will not be settled by committees assembled in Washington to call the shots.
Perhaps we could have one more question here, and then Dr. Thomas can go to the other lecture room.
The question is, what is my view of psychiatry? And then what I think I'd have to say is a totally unrelated question. What has that got to do with my view of music? And I guess the fact that I've just said that it's unrelated tells part of the story. I have high hopes for psychiatry in the future.
Dr. Thomas will be back very shortly. I expect that the questions which will be asked in the other lecture hall and his responses will be audible in this theater. So if you keep the noise down.
Perhaps we can have some few questions here, and then we'll take it back to the other room. Could you please come forward and ask your question here into the microphone to others? We'll repeat your question. What is it?
Question sort of asked why I stopped where I did, and why having the sense of
we have one or two questions here. I'm not sure whether they're hearing us in the other room. And then we'll go back. Yes.
The question is about psycho-cybernetics and after Begor. I don't really know anything about it. Adamar wrote a nice book about that. Yeah. And who was it? Poincaré had a flashing insight into the mathematical problem. I think we need to get on a bus.
No. One more question here, then we'll have to go back. Yes, back there.
Yes.
yourself for your... Ladies and gentlemen, I'm told that the noise in this room is going into the other theater. Well, we're not succeeding in getting them. But the noise here is going in to that extent that it's very difficult for Dr. Thomas and that audience.
It's the most interesting social evening I ever had.
I think we'd better go back to the main theater, but thank you.
Express your thanks to Dr. Thomas for his lecture this evening. I will call on Dr. Gert.
Dr. Thomas, Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, for such a magnificent performance, what can one truly say? It's been a beautiful, magnificent day in British Columbia at its finest. But to find oneself in a lecture ending on the same note of magnificence is truly a privilege. Dr. Thomas has without doubt lived up to the expectations of the audience that was so large that there was barely room for the speaker. He's taken the hard message of science and translated it so easily into the poetry and the prose and the music, and in fact into the fun, if not a friendly image of science, so much needed. Dr. Thomas, and I should say Mrs. Thomas as well, have greatly illuminated us all this week. And I would like to ask all of you on this day to join with me in extending thanks to Dr. Thomas, who on a day when the horizons were beautiful, elevated them all that much more.